Leon Fleischer has had an esteemed career as a musician, conductor, and teacher. He made his Carnegie Hall debut in 1944 when he was just 16 years old. In 1994, the magazine Musical America named him Instrumentalist of the Year. And in 2007, he was given a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Kennedy Center Honors. But in his prime, Mr. Fleischer suffered what would have seemed to be an insurmountable setback. At the age of 36, he lost the use of two fingers on his right hand due to an ailment called focal dystonia. In his new book, My Nine Lives, a memoir of many careers in music, Maestro Fleischer discusses the near-suicidal depression that followed his search for a cure and his eventual redemption through music. The book, which was co-written by Washington Post music critic Anne Majette, is published by Doubleday. I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Fleischer back to our show today. Welcome. So it's a pleasure to have you here.
My pleasure to see you again.
And you've been on the show a number of times, most recently in 2007 when you were a Kennedy Center honoree. Were you already working on this book?
No. Anne and I started it, I don't remember exactly. It must be about a year ago that we started having our talks. She's quite extraordinary, a very aware and sensitive person. It was a pleasure to work on this with her, I must say.
Well, this story does have the kind of arc that we associate with good fiction, for example. Starts off with success and there's a problem and then you overcome the problem. You say that if your story is about anything, it's about being very careful when your dreams come true.
Yeah.
Are you saying we should fear success?
No, but... I think one of the things I learned is that pretty much everything in life is transient on one scale or another. You know, from the moment we're born, we're getting ready to die, basically. But there's a lot that can be done in between. And why not have fun doing it?
Well, you say that a recording that your parents gave you on your 12th birthday was integral to your musical development. I'd like to play a little bit of it.
Of that recording?
Yes.
By the very same people?
The very same people. Of course, this is not on a 78 RPM disc.
Oh, too bad.
Well, we didn't hear any piano there.
No, piano doesn't come in for about another 4 minutes. Didn't that just raise the hackles on your neck?
That was fabulous.
Oh, it's extraordinary. And if that
really
is...
And that
really
was recorded in lo-fi.
In no-fi.
So tell us what it was.
That was the D minor Brahms piano concerto. And if you're really a person of your word... that was Artur Schnabel, my teacher, whom you didn't hear. And I forget the name of the orchestra, but it was conducted by George Sell.
London Philharmonic.
Thank you, sir.
George Sell, who I associate mostly with Cleveland.
Of course. But the thing that struck me, he and I recorded this very same piece. That was part of my dream. When I said, be careful of what you dream, that was the good part. That actually came true, that I re-recorded the piece with the same man, with his orchestra, Cleveland Orchestra. And what struck me about it, because I haven't heard that in 75 years. Well, maybe 72, I lie. But it was at a much slower tempo than he took when I recorded it with him. He was, 25, 30 years older, and he took a faster tempo. I really have to kind of digest that.
Is that the conductor's decision totally, or was it Schnabel's? And weren't you and Schnabel also consulted the tempi that you wanted?
Well, I don't know what – he adored Schnabel. And
you did too, obviously.
Yes. Well, he was my teacher for 10 years, but I had no contribution to make when he recorded this with Schnabel. I think I must have been like 4 or 5 years old and across the world. I was in San Francisco when, yes, there is supposed to be at least a consultation between soloist and conductor.
And Leonard Bernstein famously gave a speech before playing with Glenn Gould. He said, "We've been fighting, and I've just given in to Glenn Gould."
Well,
I wasn't sure that was the best speech you could
have
given.
A little finky, if you ask me.
But okay, so why was this recording particularly significant to you? Obviously, it's something that led to all sorts of connections later in your life.
Well, these connections were Greek in their scope, and almost mythological in the sense that they did come about. But play this for any kid who's interested in music, who's 11, 12 years old, and it really knocked me on my behind at the time. In fact, these records were on 78, and this whole opening orchestral introduction, which is called a tutti, was on the first side. And I didn't get to the second side where my teacher was playing for a week. I just heard this, and I had these visions of Prometheus, or Thor hurling thunderbolts across the sky with the timpani, and it was amazing.
But you weren't already studying with Schnabel?
Yes, I started with him when I was 9.
But he had a rule; he didn't teach anybody under the age of 16.
Yes,
you wind up with him at 9.
And somehow, for some reason, it's not mine to question. He broke that rule.
Maybe he thought you were good.
I dasn't answer that. Not for me to say.
You say that that coming from Schnabel made you feel like you had a privileged viewpoint, that you had your word straight from the master. And in Schnabel's case, he had connections that went all the way back to Beethoven, didn't he?
Yeah, that's a
so you in the school of Beethoven?
Well, I guess it's a very direct line. I studied with Schnabel. Schnabel studied with a man called Theodor Leschetizky. Leschetizky studied with Carl Czerny, and Czerny was a student of Beethoven. So that makes me what? Great-great-grandson. Great-great-great-grandson of Beethoven. However, I always add a caveat there that the weak link, wasn't there a program, something called The Weakest Link? I think Leschetizky belongs in that category, in that he taught everybody. Half the people walking on Times Square could probably claim to be musical descendants of Beethoven because of Leschetizky. So I don't brag about it.
But do you see some kind of a sensibility that was handed down from one to the other? Because there are other people who trace their forebears back to Chopin or... Brahms.
Oh, it's probably, Leonard, it's probably what you make of it. My heavens.
A lot changed between the time Beethoven and Schnabel came.
I'll say.
But then there's that whole relationship with George Zell.
Yeah, that's another. I sometimes feel, it's not a good metaphor. I was going to say like the Mississippi, because it's a reverse metaphor, because these were great, great rivers that poured into my little brook, as it were. I've had extraordinary luck and extraordinary influences in my life, Schnabel being primary.
He led you to perform at Carnegie Hall.
Oh, well, that's small potatoes.
At the time, I don't think it was.
Well, yeah, sure, no. 10 years with a man like Schnabel makes, Carnegie Hall puts it in the background. However, there was the influence of Schnabel, there was the influence of George Sell, and there was the influence of Pierre Monteux. And these were all mighty rivers coming, you know, independently and all poured into me. So I was really incredibly lucky.
And you, in the winter of 1963, you were a big star in the musical world. You were playing in the recital series at Hunter College in a program devoted to Franz Schubert. During that series, you started noticing something in your right index finger. What did you notice was happening?
Yeah, actually, it was the fourth and fifth fingers of my right hand.
Now, those are the fingers that hit the high notes.
That's right. You know, it's very interesting. I'm not sure that every pianist will agree with me, but if you look at the insides of a piano, if you look at what they call the lyre, where all the strings lay, down in the bass where the left hand plays are the really long strings, the big resonant sounds. And you get up to where the right hand plays, and especially because the tune is in the pinky, is in the fifth finger and the fourth, those are weak fingers in the hand, and the strings in the piano are much shorter. They don't have that same resonance. So
you have to hit them harder?
In a very real way, you have to work harder somehow with the right hand. With people with focal dystonia, it's almost invariably in the right hand.
Is a focal dystonia a common problem for pianists? Are there any similarities between it and carpal tunnel syndrome?
No, those are different syndromes. Focal dystonia is a neurological movement disorder. It's somewhat akin to a category of Parkinson's and a category called essential tremors. There are about 10,000 musicians around the world who suffer from focal dystonia, and they include oboe players, horn players, guitar players. There are many, many famous names who have suffered with that. Historians believe that Schumann's problem was focal dystonia.
And then you had an accident, which compounded the
Well, system. that was just the kickoff point. That precipitated the problem, but I don't think it contributed in any way. I cut my thumb on a piece of garden furniture, and you know.
Well, people cut their thumbs all the time.
All the time, certainly.
So here we are. It's 1964-65, which was supposed to be one of the greatest years of your life. Mm. And suddenly you're having difficulties.
Yeah, I was supposed to take off on the first American tour of the Cleveland Orchestra, which was the great, arguably the best orchestra in the land at that time. I know New Yorkers, Chicagoans, Philadelphians, and Bostonians will not agree, but I think Liverpudlians and Mancusians probably would agree.
Well, we were very lucky. We had some great orchestras. The great Bruno Walter was in Chicago.
Yes, of course. And Reiner was in Chicago. Stokey and Ormandy were in Philadelphia.
We had Toscanini and then Bernstein.
Yeah, sure. But the Cleveland Orchestra was doing its first tour of Russia, and I was going along as soloist. And because of this unbelievable thing called focal dystonia, I had to cancel. I couldn't go. I couldn't play the piano with two hands.
Well, so you had to do other things. You became a teacher and a conductor.
Well, but, you know, that it falls trippingly off your tongue, Leonard, but it took me 2 years of misery.
Yeah, you said you
depression.
Were near suicidal.
Yeah, I couldn't do what I had spent my whole life doing. Who wouldn't feel suicidal?
My guest is Leon Fleischer, who's written with Anne Midgett, My Nine Lives, a memoir of many careers in music. It is published by Doubleday. So you obviously went looking for all sorts of treatments. I've interviewed another pianist who had a problem with one of his hands, Juan Carlos Martins.
Who has
searched his whole life for the cure to a problem. In his case, a pebble had embedded itself in his hand while he was playing soccer in Central Park before a concert.
That's right.
But
that's not the thing that I would advise most musicians.
Well, I don't think he will anymore. But anyway, so you went searching for all sorts of different cures.
Yes, yes. From
everything. What were doctors saying? Did they know right away?
No, they did not. That was the thing. It was not known as a syndrome when I went looking. And I found many well-meaning doctors and surgeons who were willing to operate on this, operate on that, but all experimental.
And what would an operation have done?
Who knows? Who knows?
But you resisted.
I resisted.
And then you discovered, well, Botox was used for something totally different.
Totally different. There was a program, though, eventually at NIH in Washington that was working on musicians, quote, unquote, problems such as this. And a good friend of mine, a neurologist at Hopkins, Dan Drachman, had been working on that problem, and he had been working with Botox. And though they don't know what causes focal dystonia, and they have no cure for focal dystonia, they have found a way of helping to alleviate the symptoms, the main symptom being this curling under of the fingers. So what they do with the Botox, which is a virulent poison, it's one of the most powerful poisons there is, they inject a minute amount into the muscle that is contracting, and it, to a certain extent, paralyzes that muscle. So it therefore allows the opposing muscle to fulfill its proper function. And combined that way, they keep the fingers somewhat extended. And I can play to a certain extent. I can't play the way I did when I was, 20, 30 years old. But I can do enough to satisfy my
ear. That coupled with deep massage, Rolfing.
Yes.
But do you have to have the massage right before you perform?
No. Usually the day before, because it takes you a little while to recover from it. But the Botox is a repeatable injection. I get mine once every 4 months, and Rolfing is a very healthy modality of physical therapy. So. Thanks to both of them, I am a functioning two-handed pianist. But for 30 years, I was a functioning one-handed pianist.
And then in 2004, you released your first two-handed performance. You did any number of performances and pieces that had been written for one-handed pianists over the years. I remember talking to you about them in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But can you say that you're more limited? You can't have a full concert schedule. But can you play pretty much anything you want to play now?
Well, no, I have to kind of pick and choose because I'm not the spring chicken I once was. I am a fall chicken now.
But that would that have been any different if you hadn't had the problem?
Well, that's an interesting question because I don't know what's due to the fact of aged joints or focal dystonia.
Well, just one other thing. You say that you had a lot of soul searching over the Kennedy Center honors. Why? Why did you have to soul search?
Want to get political?
Oh, okay.
Okay.
It was the president who was going to be handing you the honors at the time.
There is a general misunderstanding that the people who get the honors are in some way connected, that the honors are somehow connected to the chief executive of the day. That is not true, but I did not want to be perceived as having any connection with the administration of the time.
Leon Fleischer has written With Anne Majette, My Nine Lives, a memoir of many careers in music. It's published by Doubleday. It's been my great pleasure talking with him today again.
Thank you, Leonard. Always good to see you.